It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, broadband access, education, and healthcare in rural Wisconsin are all part of a new package of legislation. We'll hear from a sponsor of the new Rural Initiative.
But first, state lawmakers and University of Wisconsin officials announced new legislation yesterday that would remove one barrier that might be keeping young people from reporting sexual assaults.
The proposed bill would make it a practice to not issue tickets to a victim who has been drinking underage when they report an assault.
A few University of Wisconsin campuses have already put this into practice, but it isn't a uniform procedure throughout the state, with police currently having the discretion to issue tickets if they deem it necessary. Joan Ballweg joins us now. She's a Republican Assembly Representative from Markeson. Representative Ballweg, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, why did you decide to co-author this legislation?
Well, this is actually a project I've been looking into for the last several of terms, something that students have been needing, and I've done a lot of work when it comes to higher ed and financial aid in my time here in the legislature, so I've had lots of conversations with students and the institutions, both public and private.
Well, this bill is looking to get rid of one barrier to reporting sexual assault, and that is the fear of getting a ticket for drinking underage. How big a problem is this on college campuses?
Well, we feel that it is a very large problem, that this is greatly underreported. According to a couple of surveys that have come out recently, even the 2015 report on the campus climate survey on sexual assault and sexual misconduct, which was done by the AAU, they're showing results of near only 5% of victims of rape are coming forward. It varies, but actually victims of stalking is the highest rate of reporting, which is 25%, but that still is pretty low. So I think the numbers show, we've heard on campuses around the nation, not just here in the Madison area, that this is very underreported. And yes, the whole idea is to break down this barrier, but this is not just for our college campuses. This is a statewide law. So it's for any underage person, so that them and the victim and their a bystander that would be helping them through this, that would maybe be accompanying them to report it to police or to get medical attention, would also be given this waiver from an underage ticket.
Do you think that this could then help high school students feel more comfortable reporting an assault?
Oh, absolutely. It's probably much more prevalent to get the word out when it comes to college campuses, because there are programs when students are entering, you know, to talk about the whole gamut of things that happens when you're, you know, stepping out on your own. But this certainly is something that we have the support of law enforcement. We worked extensively with Attorney General Schimmel in getting the language just right. So we have the state's top cop, as well as our local jurisdictions that are on board with this. Many of them already tell us that this is their policy, but by having the rule of law out there, we feel that young people will feel more certain and more comfortable in knowing that this is not going to be an underage ticket isn't going to be the result of coming forward in a case of sexual assault.
And if this bill passes, do you have any plans on how you might get the word out, not just on college campuses, but as you said, maybe to high schools and younger age people?
Well, nothing specific at this point. I think the media overall has really picked up on this particular initiative with our press conference yesterday and some of the news follow-up that I'm hearing from around the state. I think it'll be something that the word will spread, put it that way.
We're talking right now with Representative Joan Bollweg, talking about some new legislation that she's co-sponsored affecting sexual assault amnesty for victims and for bystanders. And going back to the college campuses now, does the UW system, as far as you know, currently have a policy in place already about ticketing sexual assault victims if they've been drinking and they're underage?
Individual campuses do. I know that we've had a lot of support from UW-Madison campus. Chancellor Blank and our UW-Madison police chief and assistant chief are on board. A couple of them were at our public hearing yesterday. So, yes, in this particular instance, they are on board. That is their, that is currently their policy. As I said, it is the intention in most jurisdictions of law enforcement. We just want to make sure that everyone understands. For anyone who is going to be watching this as it goes through the process, it's Assembly Bill 808, AB 808. We are going to be scheduled for a public hearing coming up this Thursday morning in the Criminal Justice and Public Safety Committee. So I think I really appreciate my partner in this, Senator Jerry Prochusky, and the chair of the Criminal Justice and Public Safety Committee, Representative Clayfish, to aid in moving this initiative along.
Now, we know that when it comes to sexual assaults, that alcohol typically plays a big role, especially on college campuses. Do you have any other legislation planned or any other ideas that might get at working with the problem of alcohol and sexual assault?
Well, I think this is the major one that we need to get out there right now. There are other thoughts about on the UW-Madison campus, of course, if you're the victim of any kind of a violent crime, you have that same waiver of getting an underage drinking ticket. But that maybe is going to be the next step. We'll just try to make sure that this initiative goes forward, because this is the most underreported type of crime, and it is so much more about trying to make the victim as comfortable as possible in reporting it and seeking help as a victim.
Now, again, you said that only, we think, 5% of sexual assaults are reported. Are there any other areas you'd like to look at beyond alcohol that might help up that reporting rate?
At this point, we're just going to stay with this. I know that there has been some commentary about other drugs in the case of some of those issues here in the state legislature. We've passed quite a number of bills under the HOPE agenda, the heroin opiate education prevention series of bills that do offer some kind of a Good Samaritan type of situation, where if someone was suffering from an overdose, that a bystander or a friend could report that and have amnesty in their particular case. So there are other legislation that has been out there, but this is the one instance of violent crime, of sexual assault, that we're targeting on this particular bill.
Representative Bollweg, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you very much. And as I said, again, AB 808 is the bill that folks can follow along and help us move this to become state law. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
All righty. Bye now.
Okay, bye-bye. And that was Joan Bollweg, Republican Assembly Representative from Markeson. She's a co-author of a bill that would make it a statewide practice to grant underage drinking amnesty to victims of sexual assault.
Coming up, we'll look at efforts to help rural Wisconsin's economy and quality of life. A state lawmaker shares the new rural initiative legislation.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in a recent New York Times CBS News poll, almost half of those polled say they think a terrorist attack is very likely in the next few months. We'll talk to a foreign policy expert about how that fear is affecting voters.
First, a group of state lawmakers has drafted a series of bills aimed at helping rural Wisconsin. The bills include efforts to attract teachers and healthcare workers, expand broadband access, and improve the economy and job opportunities.
One of the authors of the new legislation joins us now, Republican Assembly Representative Romaine Quinn represents Rice Lake and Wisconsin's 75th District. Representative Quinn, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Before we get to the individual bills, what do you see as some of the biggest challenges facing rural Wisconsin today?
Well, I think the bills that we're going to touch on address some of these issues and whether we talk about. And first of all, these bills aren't to ensure that, for instance, rural Wisconsin has equal outcomes, but at least an equal opportunity to have a fair shake at attracting businesses, at attracting good teachers and physicians and other quality professionals that we need and deserve to live and have a quality of life just like every other part of the state. So we have a number of issues that we're addressing, and I'd like to get to the bills.
Well, before we do, is there a sense that rural Wisconsin doesn't get much love from Madison from either party?
No, and that's not always the case. It's just we do have unique problems, just being that we are rural, geographically much larger. Our school districts are much larger. And so we have sometimes unique problems, not always different, but unique compared to other parts of the state. And so sometimes, you know, it does take us to somewhat band together between party lines, those of us in rural districts, to make sure that we don't get left behind on some of these initiatives. So, but much of what we do in Madison does apply statewide. When you talk about just, I know you had Representative Joan Baldwin on, you know, talking about different pieces of legislation that goes across party lines and across rural and urban divides. So, we have some unique problems. It's not that the state ignores us, but it's important that there are certain areas I feel that we are falling behind.
Well, one of those areas, and you mentioned it briefly already, teachers and drawing teachers to work in some of these small town and rural school districts. What kind of legislation are you proposing to help help with that?
Sure, yeah. And if you know anything about the funding formula, what tends to happen is a lot of rural districts tend to get the short end of the stick. It appears, according to the formula, that we have very rich property, therefore better off. But in reality, we have lower incomes and much higher poverty in many areas. So that results in us receiving much less state aid. So many of our school districts are very prudent, but they're very cash strapped. And so sometimes they can't start a teacher out as high of a salary as maybe a suburban district. So what we're saying is if school districts can't offer them a higher salary, what can the state do to come in and help that? And so what we propose is legislation. It would be a teacher student loan forgiveness program. So if you commit to teaching to a rural district in a high-needs area for so many years, the state will come in and forgive part of, or sometimes all, of your student loans if you stay in that area. So it's to attract the best and the brightest. It's to make it appealing to move, live, work, and teach in rural Wisconsin, because we do have a lot to offer, but it's giving our districts another arrow in their quiver to attract the best of the best.
And have you talked to people with school districts who say, yeah, that might be just enough of a nudge to help us be more competitive in bringing in talent?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, our districts, at least in my district, and I know Representative Brooks and Representative Tranel, and even those that have just recently signed on, are very excited about that proposal. The governor himself, we've had meetings with him, and he's very excited as well. Because if you look, it's not about jumping from Wisconsin to Minnesota, but if you can start a teacher at $40,000 in suburban Wisconsin with a lot of amenities and some of the city and better life, but again, when a teacher looks to move to Clayton or Rice Lake or Shell Lake and they want to either come back home or live in God's country, but their starting salary is $29,000 or $31,000. Well, if I can say, hey, if you move here and commit and I'll forgive up to $30,000 of your student loans, that's definitely some icing on the cake that would attract the best and the brightest.
On a related note, there's another piece of legislation in the package that aims to bring more healthcare workers, as I understand it, to rural areas. How would that work?
Yeah, see, we talked to the folks that run the rural physician residency program. We said, if you had more access to more funds, what specifically could you help bring to rural Wisconsin? And they said, if we had more funds, we would start a residency program for OBGYNs in rural Wisconsin. And if you look, that's a huge need. And some of our bills also touch on our population problem, and part of these problems we have are due to that. But if you look at just OBGYNs, just over to the east of my district, Representative Edming, one of his counties offers no OBGYN services at all anymore. So if you're a young mother, you're driving 50 miles one way to give birth to your children. and to have that access. So that's another aspect of when you're choosing to live somewhere, if I don't have access to quality health care, I may take a second look. So, again, we want to make sure that those in rural Wisconsin have access to the best education and, of course, the best health care and doctors as well as any other person in the state.
Another key amenity, a lot of people have been talking about this lately, the governor, there was a big conference up in northern Wisconsin lately, the issue of broadband access. It's not under the market. A city can look pretty good. A suburban area can look pretty good. A company looking at a small rural area might think the upfront costs don't justify bringing that access. So what are you trying to do to nudge that a little bit and get more broadband access?
Yeah, the governor's summit was up in Minot, Wisconsin. I was there as well, and part of that talk was having some of his department come up and discuss broadband access. And so, obviously, kudos to the governor for increasing that over the last budget. Obviously, it was a tight budget, and we had to really prioritize. But that was increased over last, but we don't think it goes collectively as far as it should. Right now, we get grants or requests for grants in that total about the amount that we're asking. So we know the need is out there. And again, just like you said, sometimes it's not feasible for businesses or the private sector. And so we view broadband as an infrastructure issue, no different than roads. And sometimes there is a role for government to step in, and this is an example of that. So when you talk a broadband issue, a perfect one that ties in with healthcare, for instance, now if you get picked up in an ambulance, many times those workers are sending your information on an iPad to the hospital before you even get there. If you look at rural Wisconsin, many instances, that just can't happen. The broadband and the access is simply not there. And this is an important issue, not only for that, healthcare, but education as well. I mean, you've got schools in very rural Wisconsin that have really internet that's very sporadic. Well, how can you submit assignments or go to school online or complete the things you need to do as a student and research if you don't have access to basic internet services at your own school? So that's where the discrepancy is. And again, it's not that we are trying to guarantee equal outcomes, but we're trying to guarantee an equal opportunity from the start. So no matter where you are in the state, you have a basic quality of health care, access to good education, and other opportunities like anyone else in the rest of the state.
Talking to Assembly Representative Romaine Quinn about a rural initiative that's a package of legislation aimed at giving some assistance to rural Wisconsin, helping it stay competitive economically and in terms of quality of life. Want to get to some of the educational sides of things in addition to the broadband angle you just mentioned there. Are there some apprenticeship measures in this package and some efforts to boost STEM, the science, technology, engineering, math education in rural schools? What's going on with those?
Sure. Yeah, and when we sat down, Representative Brooks and I sat down to develop some sort of this initiative and identify a project, Representative Tranel also jumped on board and introduced grant funding for STEM. So it would give grant appropriations competitively with a capped amount to rural school districts who want to implement more STEM education courses in there. So we know this field is growing, science, technology, education, and engineering and mathematics. And so it's important that we remain competitive with other schools who have the ability to simply build on and add fab labs or things like that, which may give them the advantage. So that particular bill gives grant money to schools to try and implement some of those courses that we know businesses are looking for right now. You also touched on apprenticeship grants. So there would be an increased amount. We already have the grant programs, and they do a great job, and now we're trying to open up that access to even more businesses and more students. So, and many times, you know, a quality education is exactly what you need to get that job, but sometimes it's a quality apprenticeship. So if we can incentivize businesses to latch on to employees that are prospective and can know and work and stay in our communities, sometimes the best education comes from hands-on learning. So we want to, again, emphasize more apprenticeships if we can, especially paid apprenticeships for those students who are in college and struggling to afford that as well.
Well, looking at these projects as a whole, I imagine you'll get a fair amount of bipartisan support. But budget-wise, these aren't expensive programs particularly, but there's not a lot of wiggle room, as I understand, our current state budget. Is this something that can pass fiscal muster, given where we are now?
Well, and that's why we tried to get everyone on board right away. So obviously, when you talk about educational issues in the funding formula, there's always a rural, urban, and suburban divide. That's why it's very important for us as rural legislators. If we do want something, we really do have to come together and ask for it. So we know this isn't going to happen overnight. We know the fiscal restraints because we all talk about this. It's no secret. And we all jockey for different initiatives with different amounts of money. You know, there's money that's going to be tied to the Alzheimer's and dementia package. There's money going to be tied to the college affordability package, and I'm supportive of all those too. And so it is a balancing act, but I think we do have a good shot, especially at a lot of these bills that don't require a lot of spending, but really do have a good bang for their buck. Obviously, a lot of the focus is around the broadband too, and that's quite a bit of money, but it's a need. And as long as we start talking about that, we get the conversation going, we get people to recognize there are real needs and great disparities between rural and urban and suburban Wisconsin, I think it's going to be all the easier. So I'm happy to see we had almost 20 rural legislators sign on right away. And so that usually doesn't happen in itself. So we're excited to move these forward.
If these all pass, if these all come to fruition, how big an impact do they have on the state?
Oh, very big. I mean, you look at, it's all a snowballing effect, and they're all interrelated. So whether you talk about broadband access for schools, whether you're talking about getting the best and the brightest teacher in that school district that impacts those kids for the rest of their lives, I mean, it's a snowball effect and in every way you can imagine. So it'll be very beneficial, and they're very meaningful bills. So we're very excited to get these moving.
Representative Quinn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Romaine Quinn. He's a Republican Assembly representative from Rice Lake talking about the new rural initiative legislation.
Coming up, we'll talk about how fear of terrorism is affecting the presidential election. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. As part of our 2016 election coverage, Wisconsin Public Radio is collaborating with NPR to explore the political mood of the country. Throughout the day today, we've been exploring how fear and anxiety might impact the election, including economic uncertainty, terrorism, and our changing national identity.
We'll focus now on how the fear of terrorism is affecting voters. A New York Times CBS News poll from December shows Americans are now more fearful of terrorist attacks than any time since 9/11. After attacks by Islamic extremists in Paris and in San Bernardino, California, almost half the people polled said they believe an attack is very likely to happen here in the next few months.
We want to know what you think. Do you think fear of terrorism is affecting voters? Is it affecting your vote? Are you afraid of a terrorist attack? And is it shaping your view of the current presidential candidates? Do you think the government is doing enough to keep the country safe from terrorism? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Jeremy Suri joins us now. He's the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs and Professor of History and Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. Jeremy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, Jeremy, we mentioned one poll that apparently shows we're more fearful now than any time since September 11th of a future terrorist attack. One poll, though, do you see that in general? Do you think that's a fair characterization of where Americans are at right now?
No, I don't, actually. I think many Americans are concerned about terrorism, but it's hard to see it affecting their daily behavior. Last I checked, airports are as crowded as they've ever been. People are traveling quite a lot. They don't seem to be living on a war footing in the way we did for so many months after 9/11. We forget how scared we all were for a number of months after September 11th. So it's not to say that the fear of terrorism isn't real. It is to say that sometimes these polls exaggerate things, and I think that's significant. I think that then affects our rhetoric and our discourse and distorts the way we talk about all of the issues we care about.
So it's one thing if I say yes when a pollster asks me if I'm worried about a terrorist attack. It's another thing if I'm changing my daily behavior or not, you're saying?
Absolutely right. I think the real test is how are you behaving and are you traveling? How are you investing? Those sorts of questions are much more significant to me than how you answer a poll.
Well, there's another kind of poll, the electoral poll. Will this affect our voting behavior, if not our daily behavior? Has this put it front and center, terrorism, on our minds as we look at candidates?
I think it has, but because of these distorted views, it's having a strange effect on the election. Not a single candidate that I've heard has a plan or even a significant set of smart policy things to say about terrorism, and we're not demanding that. So maybe we're not as fearful as we think we are, but we are looking for easy answers, and candidates are playing to this abstract fear and desire to blame someone else for it. And I think a lot of the anti-immigration rhetoric we're hearing is about that. The notion that refugees are somehow a terrorist threat to our country, that's not a policy position on terrorism. That's an emotional reaction. reaction that's being channeled in a very dangerous direction by a lot of candidates out there.
I saw an interesting quote earlier today from former Defense Secretary Robert Gates, a Republican who also served under a Democratic president. He said, first of all, that the media was not demanding enough answers from presidential candidates of either party on these issues on terrorism, national security. But here's a quote on the Republican side. He says, the level of dialogue on national security issues would embarrass a middle schooler. He says people are out there making threats and promises that are totally unrealistic, totally unattainable. Do you think a lot of serious politicians, serious maybe American citizens watching this are feeling the same way as they view what the candidates are saying?
Gosh, I hear that all the time from my students and the people I talk to, and maybe I'm only hearing a select slice of the population. But I can tell you that what Secretary Gates said is precisely what my students say. And I don't think my students are intellectual, pointed head elites. I think they're actually trying to understand these issues, and they're frustrated that there isn't a serious discussion. And they would be embarrassed, quite frankly, to say some of the things that presidential candidates are saying. They would not go around talking about carpet bombing someone, for example, as a solution to an international problem. And they wouldn't say, I hope they wouldn't say some of the racist things we're hearing.
Well, you've mentioned that no one is really offering a serious plan. What would a serious plan to deal with terrorism have to include?
Well, it would have to include three components, it seems to me, and these are very difficult things, but they would have to be addressed. First would be the question of what exactly our interests are and what is a realistic set of expectations for our interests. That's the first issue. Are we really aiming to make terrorism impossible? Are we looking to create complete and full safety, or are we really trying to reduce risks, which would necessarily involve recognizing that there still can be events? We think about that in terms of crime. We don't do everything we can to eliminate every possibility of crime. We certainly behave that way with regard to shootings in our society. We haven't done everything we can to stop shootings. So assessing our interests and expectations would be the first thing. Second, we have to have a real policy for the Middle East. Many of the sources of terrorism do emanate or circle around the Middle East, and we would need to talk about seriously how we wish to bring stability to that region, what we think we can do that would address the sources of terrorism as such, and we'd have to address what those sources are. And then the third, final point is we'd have to look deep inside ourselves and recognize that some of this terrorism, if we're really talking about it, comes from within our society. If you're an American, the terrorism you really need to worry most about is a white Christian male with a gun. And we need to include that in the conversation if we're really going to talk about terrorism.
Talking to Jeremy Suri from the University of Texas Austin about fear of terrorism, the assessment of risk of terrorist attack, and it's how it's affecting what presidential candidates say and what voters do when they head to, say, a caucus next week. We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234 with Nick in Milwaukee. Nick, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess I've just got a and about the political narrative of these days. Everything is about fear, anger, anxiety. The war on terror is just a nameless, faceless thing. It's a real issue. However, the whole narrative is about fear, anxiety, resentment, over and over and over. And these are very base emotions that really, in some cases, when they get obsessed about those, lead to mental illness. And that seems the progression of this country. I mean, yeah, you can be angry, hateful, or what have you in these situations. But when that just progresses to a point that that's the sole narrative, there's nothing positive.
Nick, thanks a lot for the call. Jeremy, from how we assess voters, do you see more of fear and anger motivating people? And B, when you assess candidates, do you see people playing to that?
Well, I think definitely Nick's right on target in that fear, as Franklin Roosevelt said, it builds on itself and it becomes an end in and of itself, and candidates play to that. Demagogues do that. That's what fascism is all about. And so we are seeing a lot of fear and anger. I guess my one caveat on that is we're seeing that among those who are most vocal in the primaries. Is that the American public as a whole? I'm not sure. I think we've become more partisan, more divided, but I think hand in hand with fear is the issue of selfishness and seeing one's obligations to the community and what those are and how those are defined. That's part of the debate here as well. But there's no doubt Nick is right. And politics are supposed to be about converting fear into hope. Again, that's what the great presidents in our past, the Roosevelts and others, did, and that's not happening right now.
I've seen the case made that our presidential primaries and our gerrymandered congressional districts really give an incentive to partisans on both sides to go as extreme as they can in their direction early in election all the way through. Do you think that that the system we have is structurally set up to play to fear, to play toward anger and division?
I think it definitely plays toward the extremes for the very reasons you laid out, Rob, particularly the primary system where the turnout is very low and the turnout is from those who are the most committed party loyalists of one form or another. But I do think we have to look long and hard and ask ourselves what we're consuming as citizens, not just blame the media for this. There's something entertaining, unfortunately, about candidates like Trump and Cruz going around and saying outlandish things. And we watch that. And in a strange way, we're reinforcing that even as we're criticizing that. We need to, as citizens, even if we're not voting in a particular primary, we need to demand the kinds of shows and coverage in the media that's not about fear, but that's about substantive policy discussions. And we need to ask questions of the candidates that encourage them and require them to address these issues. And that's not happening. So I'm as upset about the average citizen media consumer as I am about the primary voters themselves.
Go to another caller now. Thanks, Nick. We'll go to Cindy in Whitewater. Cindy, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up?
I just wanted to respond that I feel like there is likely to be a terrorism attack, yes. I don't live my life in fear, though. I'm trying to proceed logically and keep going. We still travel. We're still investing in the stock market, and we are still buying things.
Cindy, thanks a lot for the call. Jeremy, do you think she's probably representative of a lot of American voters, a lot of American citizens?
I think so. I don't know for a fact, again, because as we discussed before, Rob, the polls sometimes distort the answers. But I will simply say that for myself and for many of the people I talk to when I travel and when I teach, what Cindy's saying resonates 100%. I think another terrorist attack is likely to happen at some point. But by the way, it will happen after many mass shootings by Americans on Americans, which are terrorist acts. And I'm most worried. I have children. I'm most worried about my children not being the subject or being the target of that terrorist attack. It's very unlikely. I'm more worried about someone they know who's close to them doing something violent to them. That's what I worry about. I don't worry about terrorism. It's going to happen, but the likelihood of it affecting anyone listening on the radio right now directly is actually far less than all the other bad things that could happen that are unrelated to terrorism as we talk about it. And we're focusing, I think, on the wrong things.
Talking to Jeremy Suri from the University of Texas Austin about how terrorism and the perceived risk of terrorism might be affecting voters in this election year.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you afraid of a terrorist attack on American soil? Is that affecting how you plan to vote? Do you feel more vulnerable? What liberties are you willing to compromise to improve security, if you've thought about that? And do you see that fear changing the debates and the policy conversations in this presidential election? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our discussion now about how terrorism is affecting the election cycle in the United States with Jeremy Suri.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see a fear of terrorist attacks affecting the presidential election? Does it affect your lives? Does it affect how you are going to vote? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Jeremy Suri with us from the University of Texas, Austin. Before we go back to our callers, Jeremy, I just wanted to ask, is there a sense of our government as being ineffective? We have gridlock in Congress or between Congress and the president, a fear of a terrorist attack that the government is incapable of stopping. Is there a perception of ineffectiveness, and that might lead people to turn towards somebody who's making strong, direct, violent maybe statements?
I think there is, Rob, some sense of ineffectiveness, stagnation, being stuck. And, of course, there are some facts to back that up if you look at Congress today. So there is that sense of frustration. I think at the same time, there's also a sense that our leaders are out of touch with many citizens, and there are many sources of that feeling. So I think there is a desire to find some figure who seems to identify these problems and offers a way past them. And this is always the allure of the strong, violent figure, the figure who can break through the gridlock and can make quick solutions happen. And even though Americans seem to be uncertain as to what that solution should be, they seem to be looking for someone who promises to have that solution, won't tell them what it is, but will offer that solution because of who he is and what he's done somewhere else. And that's a dangerous road to go. That's not worked in the past, historically.
Bring our callers back in at 800-642-1234. Jose Luis is with us now in Beloit. Hi.
Hello. I guess I wanted to follow up on something that your guest said earlier while I was listening. He said something about how there isn't really candidates that have been able to turn fear into hope. And I guess continuing on the muddled ideal of how a lot of Republican candidates tend to say, like, oh, I'll react with violence, but violence kind of tends to create more terrorism. And I feel like more diplomatic methods are needed to deal with terrorism, because an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. So my candidate that I kind of feel like represents a more diplomatic approach to terrorism would be Bernie Sanders. And I guess what I'm curious in asking is, what do you think of his approach on terrorism?
Jose Luis, thanks. Jeremy, any thoughts?
Well, so Jose Luis raises a great point. I mean, there's no doubt if you're on a college campus and you talk to young people that Bernie Sanders, in a very unpredictable way, has sparked a lot of hope among young people. It's amazing that someone 75 years old who claims to be a democratic socialist could do that. I mean, it's extraordinary to see. And I think that's a real issue and something that's really important and perhaps a real positive, depending on your point of view. I don't think he has a clear policy, though, on terrorism. I think he falls, unfortunately, into that quotation, Rob, that you read from Robert Gates, which is where we're not hearing serious foreign policy from him. That's not his issue. And so maybe that's not something he wants to talk about. But if people are fearful of terrorism, I'm not sure Bernie Sanders is giving them much of an answer right now.
Jose Luis, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Anita in Lindenhurst, Illinois. Anita, hi.
First thing I want to say is I'm a real liberal, okay? This is the first time in my life that I am saying, no, I don't want to be so PC anymore, because we have had the Middle Eastern people and their clerics, mostly their clerics, say to us right out over and over, we want to kill all of you. They have said that. They call us infidels. And I think that we need to take a harder stance, and I don't mean boots on the ground. I mean, I'd like to hear just one of the candidates on either side say that what they would do was appropriate more funding and more training for good intel. I don't want to hear about troops. That's highly ineffective in that culture. We need to know what's going on behind the scenes before it happens.
Anita, thanks a lot for that call. So she's worried about a terrorist threat from the Muslim world, she says, but military action she's not seeing. The focus should be on intelligence. Jeremy?
Well, I appreciate Anita's comments, and I appreciate how thoughtfully she's trying to address these issues, and she raises some very good points, but I do have a slightly different perspective. First of all, I think we need to get the facts right. There are some clerics in the Middle East who are saying they want to kill us, but not all, not even a majority. The majority of even leaders in the Middle East, let's not even talk about citizens, the majority of leaders in the Middle East do not say what Anita says they're saying. And by the way, there are a number of crazies in the United States who say similar things. So just as we wouldn't want people in the Middle East to think that we're trying to kill all of them, we shouldn't think that they're trying to kill all of us. There are bad actors in their society, but I'm sorry to say they're bad actors in our society. Two, it's not a moral equivalence, but just because they're saying some of them are saying they want to kill us doesn't mean we should go around and do everything possible to kill them. Our intelligence agencies do a very good job, though they are flawed at times, but this is a very difficult business. Our intelligence agencies are very well funded. They recruit some of the best students from our universities, and I'm happy to send my students off to work for them and have good jobs and serve their countries. They get money on a scale that our education system doesn't. Maybe that's appropriate, but I don't think the intelligence agencies need more money. I think what we need is more thoughtfulness about the appropriate use of the good work our intelligence agencies are providing us with. And where we have failed is not in the good work of our intelligence agencies or our soldiers. It's in our political leadership. And we as citizens are somewhat to blame because we choose those leaders. And that's where I stand on these issues.
Talking about the risk and fear and perception of terrorism with Jeremy Suri. And we'll take another call now. Tanner is with us in Mauston. Tanner, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to just make a quick comment on presidential candidate Donald Trump. I think that he's using, for example, ISIS and terrorism as a way to perhaps brainwash the American voters into voting for him by creating this fear among the people in our society, by saying the attack is going to come from within and that he has the solution to solve it. And as the speaker had said earlier, he really doesn't have any well-thought-out solution for this. And I think it's very dangerous if we continue to listen to comments like that, that terrorism is going to come from within, which to a certain extent is true. On the show, you guys talked about shootings. However, I think the presidential candidates are using this as a way to build fear so people will vote for them in the long run instead of actually offering a well-thought-out solution.
Tanner, thanks for that call. Jeremy, briefly as we wrap up here, is there room for a nuanced approach? You can't sum up a serious policy, as you described it, in a soundbite.
No, I agree, but I think that's what the artistry of politics should be about. Not raising fears, not exaggerating false preconceptions, but trying to explain the issues to the American public. And at his best moments, President Obama has done that. At his best moments, President Reagan did that. The one line I'd like to hear the candidate say is that the American society is in many ways safer today than it has been in years. We have some problems and some threats we face, but we need to keep things in proportion, and then we need to understand what those threats are and focus our energies on them, but not exaggerate and not misdirect ourselves. We've misdirected our resources for too long, and we're paying the price of that now.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's Jeremy Suri, Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs and Professor of History and Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. He's with us to talk about how fear of terrorism is affecting voters, and you can keep sharing your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll take a close look at a proposal to end Wisconsin's ban on nuclear power from two different perspectives.
A guest takes stock of the role of the Iowa caucus on the whole electoral process here in the United States.
And we meet a Wisconsin man who's been a musical technician for performers like Don Henley, Fleetwood Mac, and the Eagles.
Behind-the-scenes look at how those legendary bands all work on stage and on tour. That's all coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time.